Welcome to the Psych Podcast, the podcast where we talk about, as the title says, everything psych, a tour through introduction to psychology. Paul, thank you for joining me.
Great to talk to you, David.
So, Paul, today we're going to launch into the thing that is behind it all, the thing that makes us actually think, the big chunk of meat that gives us minds, in other words, the brain. Is this where you start teaching your intro psych class? Do you launch right into the brain?
It is. I begin in a very traditional way. I start by talking about the brain. I start by talking about what I see as the big idea that, you know, our minds are our brains, are the products of our brains functioning, materialism, and how important it is. And I think students who are paying attention find this shocking. and they should. It is kind of shocking. I find it shocking. And I think we're going to get to this. I also spent a good part of the class saying this doesn't mean that psychology reduces to neuroscience. I always get a bit upset when people, and sometimes they mean it as a compliment, introduce me as a neuroscientist or a brain scientist, because I'm not. Right. I'm a psychologist, and so are you.
Right. So there is something subtle there about saying it's all about the brain, but psychology doesn't reduce to the brain. In fact, it's quite philosophical, but I think we should start there because I also start with the brain as the first substantive topic, but I first like to talk about why psychology is a science. There was a time, in fact, there are still some people who might not think that mental processes, the mind, our thoughts, feelings, and the things that cause our behaviors are able to be studied scientifically. And maybe that's because they have some notion that your thoughts, your feelings, your desires, your hopes and dreams may not really be physical processes that are, or at least that arise physically. And maybe they don't even believe this consciously. Maybe they all think, of course, it's your brain. But it seems that there is some lay concept of dualism that keeps psychology or the study of the mind in a separate category as the physical sciences.
I think that's right. I think long before we've come to any insights that the mind is the brain, any insights about materialism, dualism was the dominant perspective. And I think to some extent we're natural born dualists. What I mean by this is that we naturally see our minds, our mental life, our dreams, our goals, our fantasies, our ideas as separate from the physical world. We don't feel like we are bodies. We feel like we occupy bodies. And so much comes from this. It's why religious beliefs are natural, for instance, why people all around the world tend to think that when you die, your soul will leave your body, it will ascend to heaven or descend to hell, occupy another body as in reincarnation, enter a spirit world. It's why there's so many stories, everything from fairy tales to science fiction, where people leave their body and occupy another body, or when you're asleep, you leave your body. We don't feel like we're bodies, we feel like we're minds. And this is really interesting in all sorts of reasons. But one thing is that it makes our job as psychologists kind of difficult because many people think, well, decisions and thoughts and goals fall outside the physical world and can't be studied in the same way.
Yeah, right. And you, of course, have done a lot of work showing that people have these lay dualistic intuitions, the thought, the feeling that the mind is separate from the body, or that at least it's different stuff. It seems like such a natural stance to take in a way that I think as psychologists who have been studying the mind for so long, it's easy to say, well, obviously this isn't true. This view isn't true. But there are good reasons to think that not everybody can arrive at this position that easily. And for instance, every night I dream, and in my dreams, I am walking around, I am occupying a non-physical body. I'm talking. This seems very different than my existence as a physical being during the day. There's an entire dream world that I can occupy. People sometimes have, as they're falling asleep, they have feelings of floating above their body. There's, I think, a lot of intuitive pull to the idea that your mind isn't tied down metaphysically to this bag of bones.
I was talking to somebody and they said, you know, well, what has psychologists taught us? And I said, well, one thing that psychology has taught us is that we're material things. We're, just to use a very crude term, machines made of meat. And they say, well, that's ridiculous. And I say, why? I say, well, because sometimes, like, and I gave your examples, and before I fall asleep, I float above my body and I look down on it. Yeah. How do you explain that, smart guy?
Really?
And I say, well, you think you do, you experience that you do, but, and one has to keep an open mind. It would be the most amazing thing in the world if it turned out materialism was wrong and dualism was right. It's logically possible, but it seems more plausible to me that that we have certain experiences, like your dreams, like sort of so-called out-of-body experiences. And experiences are real. I'm not doubting people feel this way, but, you know, it's to some extent, I don't doubt that people believe they've been visited by aliens or abducted by aliens. Some people believe it. That doesn't mean it really happened.
That's right. It, you know, there are even, I'm certain, psychologists and neuroscientists who, in their private life, hold religious views that are probably incompatible with materialism. And they come to work and they study the physical processes of the brain. And then they go home and they are perfectly fine believing something like that the soul may exist independently of the body.
It is interesting how you could sort of split like that. I knew a prominent neuroscientist, a friend of mine at Yale, who was fairly religious. And she would talk about people she knew are now in heaven. And I said, you know, you try to be polite, but I couldn't resist asking, well, you think all of it's in the brain. And, you know, and I think she looked at me like I was the idiot. But maybe, right. Maybe I am. To recognize that, you know, we could have one belief that's sort of unconscious, explicit belief, and another belief that is maybe more heartfelt.
Another reason that people might reject this notion of that we might call materialism or physicalism or this view that the mind is just the brain, the neurons firing, may be because they view free will as being incompatible with the view that it's nothing but neurons firing. After all, neurons firing might obey the same physical laws that billiard balls crashing into each other obeys. And where is the room for the notion of freedom of choice if that's all we are?
That's right. And there's been a lot of debate within philosophy as to the extent to which free will is compatible with a materialistic perspective on thought and consciousness and decision making. But you're certainly right that to think of us as physical things kind of takes away the notion of something above and beyond the physical guiding our thoughts and guiding our actions. Right. And there's even a broader, I think, more moral component to this. I used a phrase, which is from the artificial intelligence researcher, Marvin Minsky, machines made of meat. And, you know, you use it and kind of a little bit jokingly, but maybe I think this is actually in some sense true, but it's kind of ugly. It seems to diminish people. It seems to take away spiritual value, moral responsibility, free will. You know, it is reductive. It is certainly reductive in the sort of sense that it reduces us to physical things. But it's also reductive maybe in the ugly sense of taking something special and taking it away. So I have some sympathy for people who say, oh, what a terrible view of the mind.
You know, I don't often say when I'm teaching, I don't often say exactly what it is that I believe when it comes to debates in the field. You know, especially in an introduction class, I want people to decide for themselves. So I want to present plausible alternative views as best I can. But I do think it's important to put it out there that I am somebody who endorses materialism. I endorse the view that it is just neurons firing. Well, just is not the right word.
Yeah.
That our thoughts are caused by neurons firing, but that I definitely believe that there is something amazing and mysterious and cool and special and even sacred about human thought and the human mind. So it doesn't take away anything from my views about what human beings are to adopt this perspective. And I don't think that it threatens our common sense notions of free will. I don't think that it threatens our respect for other minds. I say that because I want to show that it is possible to believe this potentially ugly view, but clarify that it's not at all ugly for me.
Yeah, I'm also compatibilist in this way. I know people who are serious philosophers and psychologists, and they really do think that this materialist view takes away what's special and interesting about people. They're sort of say, well, we don't have free will. There's no such thing as moral responsibility. We are just machines made of meat. And I think where we both are and we aren't, we're more than that. And I have a similar take, and I think so do you, but evolution, which is I feel, and we're going to talk about this, that that our minds and our brains have evolved through the same processes through which the capacities of cockroaches and dogs and monkeys have emerged. We're animals. But at the same time, we're plainly more than animals. We're plainly more than all the rest of the animals. And you could hold both views in mind. We're products of Darwinian natural selection. We have evolved. There's no special creation involved. And yet, what has come out from the process is extraordinary. Language, culture, morality, capacities that far exceed that of any other creature on Earth.
Right. You know, the cognitive scientist Douglas Hofstadter has always had a nice take on this tension between reductionism and holism. And I think that he says it well when he points to sort of the different levels of analysis in which we talk. It's not wrong at all to say that the reason that I am doing this podcast right now is because evolution caused me to have a particular set of biological structures in my skull. It is not wrong to say that the reason I'm doing it is that neurons are firing in a particular pattern in a particular region of my brain. But it is also not wrong at all to say that I am doing this because I have had the intention today to do this, and you and I planned it. It's also not wrong to say that I am doing this because I have maybe a deep-seated insecurity about my career. These are all explanations that don't necessarily conflict with each other and that might be true. And one level of analysis just is a different way of talking about the very same thing.
Yeah, and this just shows up through and through. So when talking about the emotions, I think it's correct to say that people tend to love their children because of Darwinian natural selection. Are those ancestors of ours, those creatures way long ago who didn't care for their children, didn't treat their children specially, didn't get to reproduce. And so certain capacities ended up in our heads. But at the same time, we really love our children. It's honest love. When I spend time with my kids, it's not because, oh, this is an excellent way to propagate my genes. Right. The emotions are real. And I think in some way this hints at why, even once you get the neuroscience down and evolutionary theory down, psychology remains. We still need to talk about emotions like love. We still need to talk about your deep-seated insecurities. You guys need to talk about decisions we make.
So I guess what both of us believe is that while the brain is important to talk about in some sense, it does not all reduce to the brain, which is a view that a surprising amount of people seem to have about psychology, which is once we understand how the brain works, then we'll truly crack the mystery of why we are the way that we are.
Yeah, and you could see why neuroscience will never take over psychology by thinking of other examples. So, you know, if you want to know how a car works, you have to understand the physical workings of the parts of the car, the steering wheel and how that connects with everything. That's not going to reduce to particle physics, even though everything is in fact sort of subject to particle physics, the things work on a higher level. If I want to know how ChatGPT works, you weren't going to tell me about molecules and atoms. You're going to talk at a higher level about how it's programmed. The fact that we really have great theories of molecular biology didn't make anatomy and physiology go away. Explanation exists on many levels. And the fact that we could end up, in fact, if this wasn't true, then why stop at neuroscientists? Tell a neuroscientist, you're out of a job. We're going to replace you with physicists. And they would say, well, no, you can't explain things unless you talk in terms of neurons and the cerebellum and the hippocampus and those parts. Well, similarly, you can't explain things unless you talk about, you know, emotions and beliefs and desires and plans and so on.
You know, it is the case, though, that this... what people refer to as reductionism, the desire to reduce the higher level to the lower levels, is so attractive that across disciplines, the people who are at the edges of that discipline who are explaining things at the lower level, so biologists who focus on chemistry and chemists who focus on physics, physicists who do, you know, pure physics and math, there always seems to be something that makes them seem like the cool ones in their own field.
Yeah, there's a status hierarchy.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about something that you just mentioned, ChatGPT. The idea that our brains are doing something like what a computer is doing seems to me has to be increasingly attractive idea given how computers are getting in their complexity. But this computer metaphor that so much of psychology uses, that the brain is a computer, how seriously should we take that? Is the brain a computer?
So my answer is going to be, and this is going to be frustrating, but it's the only answer one could give. It depends what you mean by a computer, or depends what you mean by the analogy. Is the brain wired up like a MacBook Pro? Absolutely not. Does the way, say, the memory in the brain encoded works like a computer? No. For instance, if I ask you a bunch of questions about your past, the questions I ask you are going to distort the memory of your past. If I ask you the next day, the questions I ask today may actually cause distortions in memory where you misremember things depending on the question. Then again, but for my computer, if I search for an old file, my searching doesn't affect the contents of the file. The workings are very different. So if you mean by computer something, a hardware-like structure, even a software-like structure, like a MacBook Pro, no. If you mean by computer something which computes, something which manipulates symbols and does logic and makes association, does statistics, I think our brains are computers in a very interesting way. And I would even turn this around a bit, which is, a lot of philosophers defended dualism, the idea that our minds cannot be physical things. And the reason why we're no longer dualists, there's a couple of reasons. One reason is there's so much evidence now that our brains are involved in everything we do. You could watch the brain at work using imaging methods, right, for instance.
The amazing finding would be if you put somebody in an MRI and while they were doing something, there was actually no activity in the brain.
That would be amazing.
That would break science.
there was a New York Times article, and this captures how people are natural dualists. And I remember the title. It is something in pain and joy of envy. It was a study about envy. In pain and joy of envy, the brain may play a role. and then it described a perfectly good study on the neural mechanisms involved. I mean, but the may struck me. The idea is like, where else is it going to be? If you found a brain didn't play a role when people felt envy, that'd be the discovery of all time, because it would show dualism was right. But of course, you're not going to find it. Right. So one argument for dualism was the brain isn't active, and it turns out that's false. The brain is active for everything we do. The other argument, and René Descartes, who's a brilliant dualist philosopher, said, look, physical things can't do the same sorts of things that people can do. Physical things cannot do intelligent things. He gave examples. An example maybe like playing chess. He would say at his time, hundreds of years ago, that you can't have a physical thing that plays chess. You can't have a physical thing that acts in complicated ways. You can't have a physical thing that could respond to you in fluent, well, for him, French. And now we have computers, and they can do all of these things. So they're what you call an existence proof. At least some physical things can act in intelligent ways.
Right. And there's a subtle difference between saying that this is what you just said, an existence proof, that this is defeating the belief that physical things can't make, say, judgments in complex domains, and saying that this is, in fact, how the brain does it. And those two get lumped together often. And I think it's just probably just an open question exactly how the brain is computing, because I agree with you. It's wrong to say that the metaphor carries over into, for instance, the digital nature of a computer. There is some reason to think that neurons are kind of like gates that fire, that open and close in computers, but not really. So understanding exactly how the brain is taking information and manipulating it and calculating creating the output, that's what we're in the process of doing. And it probably, as you say, not at all like a MacBook.
That's right. So, to change the hardware a bit, I could play chess on my phone can play chess. My phone could actually play chess better than I can.
Yeah.
And that is a really powerful argument against somebody like Descartes, who says, well, mere physical things can't do intelligent activities because nobody thinks my phone has a soul. It's plainly physical, and yet it can do that. But you're exactly right. You wouldn't want to make the jump to say, well, this is how people play chess. And this is a very vibrant debate regarding the sort of successes and failures of modern AI systems like ChatGPT, where they use what's called deep learning, big statistical procedures. And many people say, well, that's not what people do. And many people, including Gary Marcus is one prominent critic, but a lot of psychologists, including, I think, me, think, no, you get some success that way. And people do perform statistical deep learning analyses, but people also do something more. We think in terms of rules, we have symbols, we have something above and beyond statistics. And I'm not trying to sort of nail down the debate now, but just to point out that the fact that machines can do what we can do doesn't mean they do them in the same way.
Paul, you say something in your book that I always think is also worthy of discussion. You say there is a response to this computer metaphor, which is sort of deflationary. It's a bit of a facile maybe takedown. And the argument goes like this. Well, you know, when steam engines were invented, people thought that the brain was like a steam engine. Basic automata were first invented, people thought maybe we're like these mechanical contraptions and so on. And now we're just at the latest metaphor where we have computers. So now, just like every other time, we think that the brain must be like that most complicated piece of technology that we have.
Yeah. That argument gets used a lot. For all I know, maybe it's right. Maybe in 50 years, there'll be something else. We'll say, oh, the brain is like that, something right. else. But in defense of this connection, the claim about the brain being a computer isn't an analogy. Everything else was an analogy. So Freud likened the brain to a hydraulic system involving water pressure or air pressure. People likened the brain to an electric switchboard. But nobody thought the brain really was an electric switchboard or a hydraulic water system or, you know, a rider on a chariot. They said these are metaphors. But the computational view isn't a metaphor. The computational view, you know, for better or worse, says that that what the brain does is it processes information. It has memory, it has symbols, it has representations, and it puts together much like a computer does. Now, it could be everything we believe is wrong, and somehow the brain doesn't work that way. The brain it works in some bizarre other way we can't even imagine. But the claim seems very plausible. That, you know, when I think of a long division problem, I go through different steps and I right. think of an answer. And that's computing. In fact, the original use of the word computers about maybe 100 years ago referred to people.
Right.
People who were employed to do arithmetical calculations were called computers.
Often women.
Yes, that's
lots
right.
of women in a room doing the calculations necessary.
And it was only when the mechanical machines came down, we started calling them computers. So if anyway, maybe that makes it more plausible that this isn't sort of taking technology and importing it to people. It's rather the original use acknowledged that people are entities that can compute.
This episode of Psych is once again sponsored by GiveWell.org. GiveWell is that organization that is dedicated to helping you find charities that have the biggest impact, that is, that give you the biggest bang for your buck. This information can actually be really hard to come by because most charities just won't tell you how your money will be used, how much good it will accomplish. You know that you're helping a cause, but you have no idea how much. So GiveWell sought out to address this problem. And the way that they did it is they have a staff of 25 researchers. They have researchers with backgrounds in economics, biology, and philosophy. And these researchers spend over 40,000 hours each year just looking for giving opportunities that will maximize donors' impact. They dig into a charity's specific data, their work, their implementation of their programs. They model the cost-effectiveness of the charities to estimate which charities have the biggest impact. And most importantly, I think this will give you a good sense of the organization that we're talking about here, they make all of this research available 100% for free. So you can just go to GiveWell.org and you can access all this research. No sign up is required. They don't ask for any of your personal information. There's no tit for tat here. If you do use GiveWell to donate to these charities, 100% of your tax-deductible donation will go to those charities. GiveWell doesn't take a cut of your money at all. One of the reasons that I love using GiveWell to donate is that I can just give them money directly, and they will use their fancy models to allocate my dollars wherever they see fit to maximize that donation. But you don't have to do that. You can go and you can select any of the charities or funds that you like from their list of charities. So if you're thinking of making a charitable donation, why don't you go to GiveWell, check it out, and give it a try. And if you go now and you haven't used GiveWell to donate to these charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $500 before the end of the year, or as long as matching funds last. To claim that match, to claim the up to $500 that GiveWell is willing to match to your donation, just go to givewell.org, pick podcast, and enter psych at checkout. So once again, go to givewell.org, and at checkout, select podcast, and write in psych if you'd like to let them know that you heard about them from us. Our thanks to GiveWell for sponsoring this episode of Psych. So Paul, let's talk a little bit about what this computer then looks like. It has been said that the human brain is the most complicated structure we know of in the entire universe. I have no reason to doubt that it's the case. It's made up of 86 billion neurons all firing in networks organized into structures. It is amazing to think that out of these individual cells firing, we get something like hopes, desires, dreams, ambitions. It's hard to wrap our minds around that level of complexity.
It truly is. And if the first time you ever see a brain and see a brain in real life, you are, at least I was, amazed at how disgusting it looks, how unimpressive it looks. You would have thought when you open up a head, this incredibly complicated machinery would be, oh, with lights and tubes and flickering things and everything.
It would be like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction where it's opened up and it's just a glow. And
That's right. Instead, it looks really, it's just a lump of meat. Yeah. It's if you open up a skull, it's all bloody because of the blood. Taking out, let it rest for a while, it's gray. I've eaten brain with cream sauce.
Disgusting.
You shouldn't eat human brain. You can get this horrible disease. By the way, before we jump in, you once told me a story of how we know there's 86 billion neurons.
It's one of my favorite stories of science and how science works. So for years, the estimate for how many neurons we had was 100 billion. And this number got told and retold and propagated throughout textbooks. And nobody had really ever bothered to go back and try to find the original source. I mean, people knew that the number had to be somewhere around that huge quantity just by, you know, counting the amount of neurons in some part of the brain and multiplying it. But there wasn't a real good source. And so there was a scientist who decided to try to test this. And she ran into the problems that you might anticipate, which is, well, you could use the method of counting the amount of neurons in one small piece of the brain and then extrapolating, which may be, like I said, how we got that 100 billion number. But the big problem is that the density of neurons varies greatly throughout the brain. And so you need to know what the density is in every area that you're sampling. And soon, you know, you're getting to counting up all the neurons again, which is impossible. So she came up with a clever idea. And that idea was to essentially put the brain in a blender, make brain soup. In doing that, what you're essentially doing is mixing up the neurons in the brain into a soup that is equal in density across all of the volume. And so now you can randomly sample little bits of that soup and extrapolate. And she's the one who arrived at the 86 billion number.
It's both a clever and a gross story. I like that. I like
it's
that
a brain soup, a lot. Yeah.
So how do neurons give rise to thought? And there's actually two questions here. One is, how do neurons give rise to sort of intelligent reasoning, which is the sort of computer analogy. Then there's another question, which is will engage us when we talk about consciousness, which is how do these neurons give rise to experience, qualitative experience, what philosophers call qualia, the feeling of what it feels like, you know, to stub your toe, or you know, or eat something delicious, or you know, smell a flower, hug your child, you know, and that's sort of a problem above and beyond. So the story is basically. The simplest answer is we don't know, but we have some inklings. We know neurons communicate with one another through neurotransmitters, chemicals that get squirted through from one neuron to another. We know there are many types of neurotransmitters, and these neurotransmitters have different effects on neurons. And many of the sort of pharmaceutical drugs, everything from recreational drugs like ecstasy to drugs that treat disorders like Parkinson's or schizophrenia, work by fiddling with neurotransmitters or fiddling with how well neurons make them or stop making them or receive them. I read this wonderful book by Matthew Cobb called Idea of the Brain, where he pointed out there was a wonderful debate running through neuroscience a while ago called, had a colorful name, The War of the Soups versus the Sparks. And the soups thought neurons communicated with chemicals, and the sparks thought there was an electrical charge jumping from one to another. And people say scientific debates never get resolved. This one, the soups won. It's soup. Neurons communicate with one another. Neurons cluster together in something called neural networks, which are things which are both a term about the brain and a term about computational models of the brain. And then in the brain, one core and important finding, which is something which people learn first time taking an intro psych course, is the brain is not a big bowl of porridge between our ears. Some early philosophers like the British empiricists thought the brain is one big association network, that just everything just works smoothly together and it doesn't matter where anybody is. But of course, the brain breaks up into parts, just like the body does. So you have parts like the hippocampus involved in memory. You have the frontal lobe involved in self-control, the amygdala, which plays some role in emotions, and so on and so forth. And, you know, people, neuroanatomists, will give incredibly detailed maps of the brain. And it's never as simple. So we should jump into that. Oh, this part of the brain corresponds to love. And this part of the brain corresponds to making moral decisions. And this part of the brain corresponds to remembering facts. Complicated functioning, these involve many different parts of the brain working in concert. But at the same time, the brain does have different parts which are specialized for different functions.
Right. And there are various ways in which we can know this. But one obvious way is that whenever you have brain damage to a particular area of the brain, you'll often get selective effects on a particular part of somebody's psychology.
Right. So there's parts of the brain like Broca's area and Wernicke's area involved in different parts of language. And right. You get damage to those due to a stroke or an accident. You might become aphasic and lose the ability to speak or to understand language. And surgeons, when they cut into your brain for brain surgery, often have to use various techniques to localize your language area, because that's right. One part they don't want to mess up with, or they don't want to cut into. So this localization, which is very interesting. Then you got the story of the phrenologists, which I kind of love.
Do you want to take this? Sure. I was just watching the Tarantino movie Django Unchained, in which the Leonardo DiCaprio character actually takes out a human skull and gives a little speech about phrenology. And says these dents on the inside of the skull are the parts of the brain that are involved in this faculty or that faculty. The idea was that you could tell essentially individual differences, things like intelligence or moral character, by looking at certain parts of the skull. Because if the area of your brain that was involved, say, in moral character was bigger, then it would cause bumps in the skull. And so the science of phrenology was perhaps the first claim that the brain was localized, that it was divided according to function, but it got a lot wrong. didn't really bother to verify whether or not this causes bumps in the skull, and whether or not these areas that they said actually were the areas that affected certain faculties.
Yeah, Gall had like one very good idea and one very bad idea. The good idea was the localization. And if you look at those maps that you see, and often you see these lovely maps that are brain all carved up like a like those cows in a steakhouse where they show you on the menu to where the different parts come from. And Gall, you know, a while ago gets a lot of things right about what the functions are. That's the good idea. The bad idea was the idea that exercising that makes your skull bulge in certain ways. So you have these phrenologists who would rub their hands over people's scalps. And this used to be so popular. The Queen of England was fascinated, hired people to rub their kids' heads. Karl Marx was a devotee. For a while, this was all the thing where, you know, people would just look at you. And then, of course, there was the extremely ugly history of our field with regard to race, where people would be taking calipers out and talking about different races and the different parts of their heads that bulged and the size of their brains and everything. This was a terrible idea.
That's right. It was used more to justify some pre-existing nasty notions than it was to actually discover anything.
So the idea of phrenology, the taking away the head bumps, is that of localization. And there's a lot of controversy in our field right now. There's nobody who denies the brain has parts that have different functions. There are people who would argue back and forth about specific domains. So for instance, I think the evidence is very strong for an area of the brain specialized for recognizing faces, the fusiform face area, I think it was called. Other people are more skeptical. And they think, no, it's not really a special face area. It's been evolved, specialized for other things that doesn't only include faces. So there's a lot, as you can imagine, these are the sort of interesting debates where people collect a lot of data and make arguments back and forth. And it's not that there's a part of the brain for every special thing we do. There's not a part of the brain for playing chess and another one for playing backgammon. On the other hand, nobody doubts that there's, for instance, the visual cortex, which is part of the brain devoted to processing what we see.
That's right. And it also doesn't mean that there can't be areas of the brain that flexibly take over functions when one area of the brain isn't working well. So we know that this is the case. The example that always comes to mind for me is echolocation in certain people who were born blind. They start using the sound that bounces off of objects, walls, trees, whatever, as a way of navigating the physical world around them. And when you look at their brains, it turns out that they're using areas of the brain that in sighted people would be used by vision. So there is a lot of flexibility in what those brain areas can do. People who have strokes that damage one part of their brain entirely can often relearn those skills. And when you look, it's not that they got function back in that area of the brain, but rather some other area took over.
And there's more flexibility when you're young, right?
Yes.
I think if you're very young, you can recover from brain damage, often severe brain damage, much better than somebody at our ages.
That's right. I have a young niece who had severe brain cancer, tumors that were riddled throughout one side of her brain, causing seizures. And she got to the point where the only thing left to do was complete hemispherectomy. So they removed half of her brain. She was luckily young enough that if you were to talk to her now, you would have no idea that she was walking around with half a brain. Maybe you could tell a little bit that one side of her body seemed a little weaker than the other side. But other than that, she learned everything again that she needed to.
Yeah, well, a hemispherectomy for you and me would be pretty destructive.
Be pretty devastating.
Pretty devastating. And there's also a lovely case. It's not just recovering from damage, but it's also learning. There are some studies showing that London cab drivers who develop, I think, what's called the knowledge and just a wonderful sense of where things are in the city, in their city, you can look at their brains and see actual physiological changes. It's that massive a transformation as a result of their learning. And Joe Henrich, he didn't do this work, but he talks about it with regard to his arguments about cross-cultural differences, points out that for people who can read, and reading literacy is a human invention. We haven't evolved to read. It's a human invention that many cultures, not all, have. Because you learn to read, a letterbox is created in your brain, a special dedicated system for reading and transcribing what you read into the language that you know. And again, this is a physiological change that it's not, if you looked at a letterbox and said, oh my gosh, there's a letterbox, this must be hardwired, this must be part of genes, you'd just be wrong. It's something which we develop in our life.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, anybody who's literate, try to look at letters in your native tongue and not automatically process them as language. You'd be a difficult thing not to notice it, but this is all technology. This is technology that humans created that has taken over large chunks of our neural functioning. I think aliens who are not sophisticated enough to know how brains work might think that this was absolutely part of our brain that was there from birth, or maybe selected for just for writing.
So you talked about hemispherectomies as an extreme example of recovery after brain damage. And it's hard not to hear the word and think about the debate between about left brain people and right brain people in different parts of the brain. And so when students ask you, are there left brain people and right brain people, what do you say?
I'm very patient with them because that's the kind of professor that I am. But I try to disabuse them of this notion. I mean, this must be true in every field, but there are myths that propagate that become quite annoying. And one of them in psychology is this notion that you are either a left brain person or a right brain person. Now, it isn't built on, it's not completely built on sand. There are reasons that I think this myth about left brain or right brain dominance came about. And that is because there really is, there are differences in what the left and right hemispheres do. And so, for instance, you were talking about facial recognition. There turns out that one side of the brain is better at facial recognition, one side of the brain is better at language. So there are these hemispheric differences. And we know this very nicely from split brain patients. These are patients who have had the corpus callosum, that bundle of nerves that actually allows the two hemispheres to communicate with each other. When you split those brains in a set of very clever experiments, we learned that one side of the brain is just better at certain things than the other. Now, does this mean you're right brain dominant or left brain dominant? No, I think that's just a metaphor. You know, people want to say you're better at reasoning than you are at art. You can just say that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. If we're kind of bashing folk ideas about psychology while we're at it, learning styles is sort of similar. I've heard people talk about learning styles and say it as if they're sort of real things, important ways which you could carve apart people. But it's largely a myth. I mean, some people are sort of, you'd like, prefer to use language. Some people prefer to get visual cues. But the idea of sort of these separate styles breaking you up into separate kinds of people is a myth. The experiments you described of cutting the corpus callosum are in a certain way absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
Because normally we're one, each of us is one person, because our left brain and our right brain coordinate perfectly in milliseconds back and forth. So the idea of a duality doesn't seem right. But you chop the brain in half, and then you have typically one hemisphere, the left hemisphere usually, has language. Yeah. While the right hemisphere does stuff like recognize faces and has other capacities. And the freakiest thing is that these hemispheres, these parts of you, often have different priorities and different goals. So one thing you have to know, which is a little bit strange, and I've heard different theories as to why, but there's a weird crossover where the left hemisphere operates the right hand and the right leg and sees the right side of the visual field. The right hemisphere does for the left, and so there's this crossover. So they each control a hand, basically. Yeah. And there's alien hand syndrome, where somebody who with a cut corpus callosum could be putting on clothes with one hand, and then the other hand slapping that hand out of the way.
Yeah.
There's stories of these patients reaching out to hold somebody they love with one hand and the other hand kind of trying to smack at them. And And this has freaked out neuroscientists. And it's not clear what to make of this, but one idea is that there's really two yous that are almost, that for everybody normal is in concert, but people who are unfortunate enough to have a corpus callosum cut, they sort of separate. And then you walk around two separate selves.
Yeah, it's an incredibly mind-blowing idea. And, you know, the YouTuber CGP Grey, who does a lot of educational content, animated content, has a video where he describes these patients nicely. And in the end, he concludes, maybe we all have two separate selves housed within our minds. It's just that one is mute. That person does not have the ability to communicate via language. And so maybe he's trapped in a prison.
That's right. You showed me this video. You sent me this video and I saw it. And it's such an image that you're raised and then gradually language is learned by the child. And that's typically in the left hemisphere. And that's a person. That's his own person. And that's the person who speaks to everybody and talks and basically lives a sort of social life. And next to it is this sort of silent right hemisphere. Yeah. Who's trying to keep up and find whatever, just kind of shrugs and says, I want to watch this person talk. Yeah. And the idea is that right now, you and I are talking, our left hemispheres are humming away, and there's the right hemisphere kind of just sitting back and saying, well, I guess this is what happens here. And I hope this is worthwhile. I'm going to recognize some faces.
That's right. So. Well, let's take this to its extreme and maybe reach an extreme conclusion. I was speaking earlier of my little niece who had a hemispherectomy. She is still her, right? She has the identity. She went in, got an operation, awoke. When she awoke, she had fewer language faculties. She had to relearn a lot. But she was, let's just call her Jane. She was still Jane. Jane went to sleep and Jane woke up with, some fewer abilities than she had when she went to sleep. Now, this means that a human being, their identity can persist with only one side of their brain. Imagine that her brain had been healthy, and yet half of her brain had been removed. And say we had the technology to put that half of the brain into a healthy body and wire it up. Now, both of those people have an equal claim to the identity of Jane. What's going on here? Is it really the case that these two people could both be Jane?
It's one of the things I love about psychology, which it makes real philosophical puzzles like that about identity and selfhood. And these puzzles, which might seem like, this is very abstract and sort of it makes no contact with reality. Puzzles like, if you copied all the neural connections of you and put it onto a computer, would that computer be you? These puzzles become real in psychology. We really have to wrestle with them for people walking around who have split brains.
Yeah.
We should say, by the way, because we didn't say this before, that the reason why they cut the corpus callosum of people is typically, not always, there's other things, but typically because they have epilepsy.
That's right.
And if you have severe epilepsy, the electrical storms just go right through your entire brain. So one very radical solution to this, and I don't think it's still done, is cutting the corpus callosum.
Cut the wires so that
the
seizures don't become hugely devastating to both sides of your brain. That's right. That's right. But what you were saying about these philosophical thought puzzles, I mean, the philosopher Derek Parfit came up with these examples, and probably building on philosophers before him, of this very thing. And as you say, these seem fantastical, and they seem like sci-fi puzzles. But increasingly, we're at the point where we might be able to see some of this actually become possible. And our intuitions just are not built well to deal with this stuff.
It's where psychology gets the most interesting and the most unintuitive when we deal with these questions and we're forced to confront these issues. And they show up all over the place. They show up in the cases we're talking about of split brain patients and hemispherectomies. They also show up in very different ways when we talk about mental illness. questions like multiple personality disorder, schizophrenia, questions of moral responsibility, questions of what makes a coherent self, what makes the same person a person over time. There's radical cases of amnesia, for instance, yeah. which call into question the role of memory in the self. And so in some way, what I'm excited about psychology for many reasons, but one way is it seems like the best embodiment of the most interesting philosophical questions, except now they're real. So let me ask you something. You and I both begin our intro psych classes the same way, by talking about the brain and remember the cerebellum and the hippocampus and dopamine and serotonin and everything. And then we go on to the rest of the course. And if you're like me, there's not much more of that. Not because we've given up the idea that the mind is the brain, but just that these questions are not so relevant for the details of what we're talking about later on. So I'm wondering about your own research. You're a social psychologist. You study all sorts of things, including a lot of aspects of morality, our sense of right and wrong. What role, if any, does any of this neuroscience play in your work?
I think, much like you, it doesn't play much of a role for me. There are people who think that it ought to play a lot more role, say, in my theorizing. To give an example, I, along with you, in some cases, have studied the emotion of disgust. Now, there are very interesting debates in the field about what the neural basis of the emotion of disgust is. What are the neural correlates of disgust? Where in the brain is it located? What are the mechanisms that give rise to disgust? And you have a lot of studies that have used functional magnetic resonance imaging, trying to locate, you know, get people into an fMRI machine, gross them out, and you can see what areas of the brain are involved in disgust. In my work, it almost matters not at all. In fact, I will say it matters not at all. It is an interesting question. It's just not the question that I'm looking at. As we were talking about before, I am just working at a different level of explanation. So I'm interested in the role that the emotion of disgust might have on judgments, social, moral, political judgments. And so one of the things that we might do is bring people into the laboratory, gross them out with something, some pictures, some smells, and then see if their judgments have changed, see what happens to their thoughts after they've been disgusted. Whether or not disgust is located in the insula won't change my conclusions there. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. I have a couple of quotes in front of me that I enjoy. One is by Jerry Fodor, who says, "If the mind happens in space at all, it happens somewhere north of the neck." What exactly turns on knowing how far north? And Matthew Cobb, who I quoted before about the war of the soups and the sparks, says, "A map, and at their best, this is what fMRI, brain imaging data, are, does not tell you how something works. Where is not how. The next time you read the claim that a particular ability or emotion or concept has been localized to a particular region of the human brain using fMRI, ask yourself, so what?" And my feeling is pretty much the same as yours. I'm embarking on a series of studies with young children, looking at their notion of moral obligation. And I'm working with these brilliant students, and they're coming up with some great discoveries about how children differ from adults. And I don't, if somebody told me, you know, for $100, I'll tell you where in the brain all this happens, I wouldn't pay. It doesn't matter so much. Right. Having said that, each of us could think of some really interesting examples where neuroscience can bear on interesting questions. It tends to happen more with sort of more, call it lower level capacities like right. vision, yeah. Or spatial understanding. But also, you know, there's some lovely work, for instance, on people's understanding of number. And it turns out that different kinds of numerical calculations that you might have thought were kind of the same, like estimating, giving a broad estimate of, say, you know, what's 47 plus 52, just roughly what that is, versus being asked about exact numbers, exactly what it is. You might think, oh, the same part of the brain does that, same mental process. These studies tend to find that different parts of the brain do that, which suggests that it's different psychological, that doesn't prove, but it suggests that they're different psychological systems. And I think certainly in principle, brain data can bear on sort of questions we're asking. Just in practice, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
And I feel that way about a lot of things. I think I'm a developmental psychologist. So for the questions you're asking about disgust, developmental data development. It has to be consistent with development, that we started off as babies and became children. But right. it's not clear you need to do development experiments to work out your theories. Our brains evolve through natural selection, but that doesn't mean we won't have to be evolutionary biologists. There are a lot of roads to understanding.
For some reason, it sounds almost sacrilegious to some people to say that as a psychologist, I'm not that interested in the brain. But I think that position should be understandable when you ask something like, if I study the economies of nations and how over history they have become influenced by each other. Of course, I believe that people are making decisions that affect the economies of nations. But will it help me that much to understand individual psychology if what I'm trying to understand are the machinations of entire groups of millions of people?
Yeah. So there's two things to keep in mind here, because I see the world the same way that you do. I mean, one is consilience, which is a fancy term, meaning that if we are a science, everything has to line up.
Yeah.
Basically, if your theories of disgust can't fit with what we know about the brain, we got to throw out your theories or change what we think about the brain. And if neuroscientists' claims about how neurons work don't fit with organic chemistry, something got to go. Everything has to fit.
That's right.
And when we profit from seeking out this fit, we profit from interdisciplinary collaborations. So that's one thing. But then the other thing is there's sort of a pluralism in how we approach things. I find that people are fascinated by results from brain scans and fMRI machines and so on. But I often feel, and the data bear me out, that for a lot of questions, these are simply the wrong way to go about them. And there's much better ways that don't involve studying how the brain responds to different things.
So there are people who care only about understanding the brain and how it works. That is an incredible field, and one that is often informed by psychology. Because if you want to understand the neuroscience of memory, you want to understand a bit about how memory works behaviorally. And then you can go look at brain structures. As a psychologist, I may or may not care about the brain in as much as you said before, any of my claims aren't inconsistent with the data on the brain, in the same way that I think none of my theories should be inconsistent with what we know about evolution by natural selection. But that's about it.
Yeah. And to end on sort of a catty sociological note, to continue a theme you made, I was a graduate student long ago at MIT. And MIT had it wasn't a psychology department, it was brain and cognitive sciences. And so there's people like me, and I worked with my advisor, Susan Carey, on children's development of language. Didn't look at the brain at all. And we were looked down upon by other people who were the cognitive neuroscientists who did brain scans and ERPs and all sorts of things. But they, in turn, were looked down on by the sort of neurochemists and neurophysiologists who studied the detailed workings of the chemical structure of neurons, and were always kind of angling for the Nobel Prize. maybe the psychologists in this hierarchy don't get much respect, but I think we get to do the coolest work.
I agree.